Well, good morning, and thank you all for coming. I'm Frank Verastro, Director of the Energy Program here at CSIS. A couple things we want to talk about. This is Biofuels 2, the sequel. And part of it was many of you attended the earlier session we had here in September, and there was such interest and the desire for a further discussion that we thought we needed to schedule a second session. And after the events earlier this week, I think we've just kind of moved this up on the radar scope. So we're extremely fortunate to have the panel that we have today. We've provided time at the end so that we can have, hopefully, a good conversation and discussion on next steps. Doug has now joined us. We've been doing this series in cooperation with the Global Strategy Institute here at CSIS and NREL, the Renewable Energy Lab out in Golden, Colorado. Doug has participated all the way through, Doug Arendt, and he's joined us now as a senior research fellow here at CSIS. So we'll be kind of honchoing the program going forward. Initially, we envisioned maybe four sessions to this series. You know, this is like number five, and we're thinking that there'll probably be eight by the time we're done. So we still want to explore kind of waste to fuels, infrastructure issues, automotive technologies, and maybe an international biofuels piece as well. And I suspect we'll keep thinking of other things as we go forward. Just a couple of quick administrative announcements, and I'll turn this over to Doug. First of all, just out of courtesy to the panel, some of whom have traveled a long way, and also the people around you, if you have cell phones, if you want to mute them or turn them off now, that would be a great thing to do. In terms of scheduling, this may be of interest. MIT was here in September and presented a biofuels and emerging technologies. As part of that, we invited John Deutsch from MIT to come down and present the results of their coal study, their coal report, which will be out this fall. And that's now November 30th. It'll be here the morning of November 30th at CSIS. And finally, while Jennifer's still in the back of the room, I just have to tell you, when we put together events like this, and this is Thursday, I think, this is the fourth of five events that we're having this week alone that we've either participated in or are hosting. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, so I just personally want to thank Jennifer for the extraordinary effort that she's put forward this week, because it's really been helpful. This series, like all our sessions, it's on the record. With the permission of our presenters, we will post their presentations on our website, if not today, hopefully by tomorrow. She's nodding. Yeah, tomorrow we'll be able to do it. And at that point, let me just turn the program over to Dr. Arendt, and we can go forward. Doug?
No, sir. Thank you, Frank. As Frank said, I'm Douglas Arendt. I'm at the National Renewable Energy Lab, but also a visiting fellow here. Pleasure to welcome you to Biofuels 2. A couple of framing remarks just to think about as we put this series together and as this panel has come together. Biofuels is constantly in the press and in front of all of us, and there is a lot of information and a lot of misinformation. And so what we've asked and what we've tried to do is to bring a number of different perspectives to the table, hopefully backed up with some reasonable analytics. And we're asking our panel to bring together all of the different elements of the drivers in the marketplace. That's energy, environment, and security, clearly. But also to think about all of the different elements which are really pushing biofuels into the press and into everyone's minds these days, and that would be everything that might be included, for example, the provisions in EPACT in terms of some of the fiscal incentives, some of the renewable fuel standards, certainly some complications with the agricultural industry and pressures on pricing, and you'll hear some about that and have to think about that, as well as the policy implications between the fuels markets, the transportation market, and the ag market. We also want to think about the investment side of the equation. We'll hear a little bit about that from a couple of our presenters from their perspective. And that's from the corporate perspective, but you'll also see a fair amount of press coverage with lots of conferences going around investing, how do you make money in ethanol, et cetera, et cetera. You've seen some IPOs. I think that there's room for a lot of open dialogue and debate and some myth-busting and that reflection. And I think we also can't forget the demand side of the equation, which is one thing that Frank mentioned. We are going to put together a transportation technology session, which will come up early next year, and that's really to look at the demand side of the equation, because right now we're focused on supply, and we really need to think about what that looks like from both sides. So we have a very distinguished panel this morning. Please welcome, join me in welcoming Rob Annex, Lou Burke, Reed Dutchin, Adam Schubert, and Eldon Bays. I'm not going to read their bios since you have them in front of you, and we're going to turn directly to the presentations. We're going to have each speaker speak for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. We'll see how fast it goes. If we have time, we might take a short break. If not, feel free to take a break, grab a drink as you'd like. What we'd like to do is preserve a significant amount of time at the end for questions and answers, and we'll come back to that. So to start us off, Rob, if you would mind. This going here.
Well, let me, as Doug tries to get this thing going, I'm an old mechanical engineer, and I spent about 8 years at the University of Oklahoma in the Institute for Science and Public Policy, and then the within the Sarkis Energy Center, which you should interpret to mean worrying about oil and gas. And then I saw the light and moved to Iowa State and started worrying a lot more about corn and beans and biofuels. And so I'm going to focus my remarks on the feedstock end of things. We know a few things at Iowa State about conversion and other aspects, but fitting the order of the speakers, I'm going to focus mostly on feedstock issues. And I want to first sort of set the stage here a little bit by talking about corn grain ethanol. So where we are today, there are about 103 ethanol plants with 4.8 billion gallons of capacity. I won't just read you all these numbers, but we're using about 13% of the corn crop, which is a significant way of adding value. You see 20 to 50% per bushel increase in the corn price within the catchment basin of a dry mill in Iowa. And Iowa, the largest corn-producing state in the union, is about to become a corn importing state. If you look at the plants that are planned to come online in the next couple of years, there will not be enough corn produced in Iowa unless you take it away from animal feeding or reduce exports. We will be importing corn, or else it will come from somewhere else, which starts sort of an interesting spiral of reactions in the market that are very hard to predict. But as you all know, corn grain ethanol is sort of going great guns. The return on investment after taxes is about 30%. So investment has been rapid, and that's how we've gotten to where we are. Although, as I note here, 40% of the gas is blended with alcohol. That's mostly as an oxygenate, right, to meet air quality standards, not so much really as a fuel source. One of the big drivers thus far has been air quality. Now we're moving into really where it is a fuel. And this I've sort of already said, that at 4 to 6%, right now we're at about 2%, right, of our gasoline is replaced, if you will, by ethanol. When you start to get to 4 to 6, that corn's going to come from somewhere. It's going to start to be bidding against animal feeding, right, bidding against feeding and affect the price of meat down at the local market, which may be a good thing, depending on how you feel about our meat consumption, but you have to be careful. I'm from Iowa State, but I say some things about corn that may not always be completely endorsed by my university. Maybe I should disavow that I speak for my university. If you took every bit of our corn crop and converted it to ethanol, you could replace 12 to 15%, depending on what year we're talking about in terms of corn yields. The yields go up and down. But what corn grain ethanol has done is it has primed the pump. Right, we have an active market. We have a distribution system. We have production. We have an ethanol market. And I think that's a very good thing, because what I'm going to tell you now is that cellulosic ethanol has a whole bunch of very significant benefits. You've all heard it, but I'm going to go through it anyway. And the billion ton a year steady, which, of course, this scenario that I have up here is 1.3 billion, has a significant amount of cellulosic ethanol. You see about 20% of it coming from corn stover and about 35% of it coming from perennial. Now, if you're using corn grain, which isn't going to go away in terms of feedstock for ethanol, and corn stover, that's still a lot of corn, right? It's a lot of economic driver for producing more corn. Whereas perennials is a little bit different, and I'll say something more about that in a minute. But let's just talk for a minute about corn production. Ethanol, of course, this is a slightly old picture of where the ethanol plants are in the country right now. They follow corn, right? At the moment, we make ethanol from corn in the Corn Belt. And growing corn, whether you're turning it into ethanol or not, has some significant environmental impacts, which I will elaborate here for a moment or two. This is nitrogen yield per kilogram per square kilometer per year. What you see is where the most corn is, the dark red, a whole lot of nitrogen comes off the ground into surface water, right? And that gives us a hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. This is highly simplified, I recognize, but you put a lot of nitrogen on the ground to grow corn. You put it on at the time of the year when it's not going to be highly, completely utilized by the plants, goes into the water, ends up in the Gulf of Mexico, and in the surface water of the Mississippi, Missouri, et cetera. Similarly, there's a lot of soil erosion. What you see here is sort of a value. It's the cash rent of land divided by the topsoil depth remaining. So what it really is just the value of the erosion, right? And so erosion is costing us money in terms of future productivity, agricultural productivity, in the same places, right, where we grow a lot of corn. And this is government payments divided by net farm income. And you see the same sort of pattern. Yes, Iowa gets about, you know, it's about 60%, right? Government payments as a fraction of net farm income. And yes, Montana is 112, which tells you something about the productivity or the value of agriculture in some states. But subsidies, right, countercyclical payments, direct payments, are driving the current agricultural system. And significantly subsidizing corn production. So corn is an annual crop. It looks something like this. It grows during that nice sunny part of the summer, right? And therefore, if it's on the ground for about 150 days of the year, doing a lot of photosynthesis for 100 of those, there's some big opportunities missed here, right? A lot of solar energy is coming down that the corn isn't turning into carbon bonds, right, turning into fuel. And furthermore, when it's sitting there on not on the ground, there's a big opportunity for nitrogen leaching and soil loss and the things that I've already told you about. And if you overplot, this is precipitation in Ames, Iowa. It's actually where I got it. Monthly rainfall, the peaks there about 4 inches. The bottom end is about 2 inches per month. You see that early period when the corn's on the ground, just little baby plants, is when we have big flushing rains, and you get things that look like this, the erosion I've already told you about, and you can see the silt coming down, even in July, from a 2-inch rain into the Mississippi River. This happens to be Minnesota. So one of the reasons that you saw that wedge in the feedstock chart of perennials is that there are big advantages to perennials, right? All these things I've been telling you about corn, sort of the opposite is true of perennials. In fact, if I go back to this one, a perennial is there on the ground all the time, right? So as soon as the sun is shining, the perennial can start growing, and it can take its nutrients in the fall and put them back into the roots. So you get a lot less soil erosion because you have ground cover. It uses nutrients very efficiently. It's a very tight system in terms of nitrogen. You put a lot of soil carbon into the soil, and then I have but. So you've sort of got a chicken and the egg problem, because a farmer doesn't want to plant a bunch of perennials until there's a plant, a conversion facility that will take it, and similarly, nobody wants to put hundreds of millions of dollars into a conversion plant when they don't know they'll have feedstock. And a perennial takes several years to get the stand established, right? 65% of the land in Iowa is on a 1-year lease. 85% in Illinois is on a 1-year lease. If you have a 1-year lease, how likely are you to plant a crop where you're not going to get a good yield for several years? Well, you can structure contracts to ameliorate that a little bit. But there's another aspect. This is what the subsidies for corn look like. All I've done is I've just taken bushel prices across the bottom, just arbitrary, right? $2.76 a bushel down to $1.77 a bushel. Right now, the Veresen ethanol plant in southern Minnesota is setting up 2008 contracts at $2.39 a bushel, which puts you sort of there in the middle, where the white bar is the countercyclical payment, the red is the loan deficiency payment. But what you're supposed to see here is that what the farmer sees never drops below $2.34 a bushel, right? The price of corn in the market can go down and down and down, but the loan deficiency payments and the countercyclical payments and then just the straight, whatever it is, 34 cents, means there's no downside. So now if you've got a one-year lease and you want to plant a perennial for which there is a big downside, potentially, right? The plant doesn't want your feedstock anymore, you have a bad year, et cetera. Are you going to plant corn where there is no downside, or are you going to plant a perennial? But there are big benefits to perennials. So what alternatives are there? How do we get from where we are now with corn and corn stover potentially to a perennial? Because I think perennials is where we want to go, but we've got to get the market going. I'm going to tell you a few things. But think about if instead of trying to produce feed or food, you're running agriculture to produce biomass. You do it completely differently. You grow different crops, you grow them in different ways, different crop sequences, and we haven't begun to do this, right? The Ag Extension Services, we've spent a lot of years designing agriculture to do what it does now, and we've spent almost no effort in what it could do and perhaps should do. You know, if you're designing agriculture to produce biomass instead of to produce food or perhaps to accrue subsidy, you might do it very differently. And the last bullet there, we need to understand fundamentally which crops grow well where and why. You guys have probably all heard about miscanthus, right? This wonder crop. Well, it has some problems. You have to propagate it by cuttings, and then you'd have a monoculture. But the reason miscanthus has huge yields is that it's a C4 warm season grass, scientific talk. It photosynthesizes at cold temperatures much, much better than other warm season grasses. The way it does it, right? The enzymes are different. And we need to understand why and how so we can identify other crops like that that don't have some of its downsides, or perhaps even take those traits and put them into crops that we like the agronomics of better. And we haven't begun to really understand how to put together in a complementary way some of these feedstock crops. So here's just an example of what I mean by that. This is something we've done. We've just begun at Iowa State, my grad students and I and some colleagues. If you take a cold season grass that is hardy through the winter, triticale, it's a cross between rye and wheat. It got the fecundity of wheat of rye and the cold hardiness of wheat, and you put it together with another crop like corn, or sorghum Sudan grass or any other number of things. You make a complementary mixture. Within 1 year, you have a cold season grass and a warm season grass. So you've got something on the ground during the winter and the spring. I'll show you this in more detail, but you still have a cash crop. Something like corn. I mean, this is just our first shot at we can do a lot more than what we're doing. This is what that would look like. You've got corn, although you're planting it a little later, so that bar is a little bit thinner. It's a short season corn. It might be on the ground for 90 days or 100 days instead of 150. But you see in the fall there, the triticale comes up and gets growing, and in the spring it really grows, and what you have is a much reduced chance for resource loss. And, yeah, you're still missing a little bit of opportunity there, right, where a perennial might capture that sunlight. And you've shortened your corn crop, so your corn yields will be a little bit lower. This is what that might look like. Here's what corn looks like on May 20th in Ames, Iowa. Actually, Boone, Iowa, just across the county border. And that's the triticale growing there on your right. And then on June 5th, we come through and mow that triticale, send it off to the biorefinery, and overseed something else. In this case, corn's on the left and sorghum Sudan grass is on the right. And you can see the stubble of the triticale there, right? So even after you've mowed it, you've got ground cover. And this is cautionary statement. The first year, one time, one shot, and we had almost no rain in June. So when we were trying to put our late season corn and sorghum Sudan grass and these other things, there's a few more that I haven't really shown you here, the Crotalaria, got off to a really bad start. But Ceres Corporation's got $1.5 million just recently given them to double the yield of switchgrass. You see switchgrass grown about, actually it's about a half mile away from these plots. So same nitrogen fertilization rate. It's about 160 pounds an acre. Switchgrass on this prime farmland in Iowa gets you 5.8 dry tons. Our first shot with corn triticale, you're at 9.7. We've almost, you know, we're getting close to doubling it. And this is compatible with annual agriculture, whereas I don't know how you're going to get anybody to grow perennials, at least under the current policy regime. So don't quote these numbers too much. We're going to do much better next year. These were phosphorus-deprived plots, et cetera, but it's possible, right? All I'm saying is that there are a lot of things possible. And so now some higher-level messages. This is sort of a bioproductivity plot for North America. Different things will grow in different places. Different things will grow well in different places. You're not going to plant triticale in Atlanta or in Georgia. There's going to be a bunch of different biomass, and there should be. So the biorefineries need to be able to use a range of feedstocks. Don't forget about wood. I mean, I know the million-ton or billion-ton-a-year study didn't, and we shouldn't. There's an awful lot of wood there. But there's a whole bunch of other things. We need to be able to maximize yield and have a resilient, sustainable system, not just business as usual with corn and corn stovers. So I would say don't pick winners in terms of choosing biomass and how biomass should be produced. We need to fund some research, as I've really already said, into new cropping systems, complementary combinations of things, and we really haven't begun to imagine what's possible. We can get an awful lot of biomass off an acre if we're growing biomass instead of growing what we're growing. I've already said this, but you know, the current policies discourage high-yield sustainable systems, perennials, even some of the dual crops that I've talked about, right? The triticale doesn't have you can't get crop insurance for it, you don't get subsidies for it. We need incentives for the kinds of systems that I've just begun to hint about. And I just sort of mentioned that one option is the CSP program. It's been significantly underfunded. It's compatible with the WTO challenges, right? You can shift a bunch of the subsidies that we're currently in. I probably shouldn't go into policy too much. I'm a farm boy now, right? But one possibility is certainly that, and I'm sure creative people can come up with others. So the corn grain ethanol industry as it exists has done a very good thing in developing markets and a beginning of the infrastructure for delivery, but there are big problems there. So there's a whole bunch of topics here that I haven't mentioned that I will just allude to, that delivery of ethanol to the big markets on the coasts, if you're going to grow it in the Midwest, is a problem. Right? The east-west rail lines are relatively saturated. We really don't want to just move everything by truck. Somebody better worry about the infrastructure and the transportation. We've put a minuscule investment in the conversion technologies compared to the scope of the problem, but at least we have started there. And we've done very, very little in terms of the supply and harvesting and storage of the biomass. Right? I've shown you forage harvesters going through the triticale, but if we're going to start talking about a bunch of different crops, we need to think about exactly how we're going to harvest it and move this non-dense material over significant distances. I think these are very solvable problems, but we have not made a significant investment in making sure we can do that. So the feedstock end of things is going to be absolutely critical, and there's an awful lot we can do, but we haven't really begun to capture the potential. There we go.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to hold your questions. If you would write them down for later, we'll have an extended Q&A session. We're now going to move down the value chain a little bit, and we're going to welcome Lou Burke from ConocoPhillips to come up and give us his remarks. And let me work the IT piece here for a second.
Thanks, Doug, and thanks to CSIS for holding this. It's a pretty important talk. One thing, Rob, you know, oil and gas, you didn't see the light when you left. Some of us still like that business, and it is an important piece of what we do, and you'll see as I scale some things forward. It's not biofuels as part of our future. It is not the entire future. In fact, if you looked at EIA's comments yesterday, they talked about world energy consumption increasing 53%. Takes us into like 650 quadrillion BTUs. If that is the demand picture we face, all forms of energy are good. And they're going to have to look at a multiple source supply as we go forward. So that's our first piece to go into this. There's a number of aspirational targets out there. And people see the growth in biofuels, they see the aspirational targets, and sometimes they don't get the scale of what we do. And I'm just going to talk in the United States today. It's basically an illegible graph. When you see the online pieces, you'll be able to go at where it goes. And there's some really simplifying assumptions in here. I'd say it's more notional than it is try and dive deep in the numbers. The top blue line is gasoline and diesel consumption as forecasted by the EIA. And as you can see, it gets up north of 250 billion gallons per year. You see where the RFS, that's the red line on the bottom, that was in the EPAC 2005, which right now caps out at 7.5 billion gallons a year. The blue line is half the corn crop. We took a stab at what is sustainable going into energy. And we increased the corn yield at 1.5% per year. Some people will tell me I'm too low. Some people will tell me I'm too high. But you have to look at what is sustainable, which includes inputs, which includes water. A lot of other pieces go into that. Yeah, you can drive the yield up, but that was our best stab at what we think is sustainable. And then the green line is 50% of the corn and all of the oil crop, oil seed crop in the U.S. converted to basically biofuels, whether it be biodiesel, renewable diesel, or something else. And 100% say, is that sustainable? Well, I didn't lump in animal fats, rendered large and things like that, which would dilute that number, and didn't build in planting different seed crops or energy crops. And you'll see some growth in that as well. So it was just a swag. And what you get is you see first generation can grow from where we are today. But if our targets are things like 25 by 25 or 30 by 30, first generation technologies can't get you all the way there. So we're going to have to look at more ways to get to those sorts of aspirational targets if those are the publicly agreed targets we want to hit. So we're going to need second generation biofuels. And some of this, Rob and I, we did not, by the way, align our slides, but you're going to see there's some consistencies as we talk forward. We did talk beforehand. I've got to say that. We did talk beforehand. But we didn't align our conversations. We're going to need a massive low-cost resource. Recognize that petroleum, even at today's pricing, is still an incredibly efficient, energy-dense source, and that you're going to need something massive and low-cost to offset a large amount of it because biomass is not very energy-dense. So we have to look at ag and forest. We talked about wood. You think about southern yellow pine, and the paper industry. And you're seeing, okay, the paper industry in the U.S. is basically offshoring, and the folks who have been planting their pine forests are saying, wait, I've got a resource I've been growing for a while, and I'm seeing declining value for that. You think of northern poplar feeding the paper industry back in my home state of Wisconsin. And so you're seeing different softwoods, different other things that how do they fit in? Obviously, you look at grass, switchgrass and things like that. Where can it go? You look at energy cane, you look at sugar cane, and you look at municipal solid waste as well. All these are potential sources, some of them negative cost feedstocks today. So you want to have something that you want a large source, and if you looked at the billion-ton study, there is a substantial source of biomass available today. You want an omnivorous technology. I had a Brit write that particular slide for me. So you saw that Rob talked about that as well. You see folks saying, hey, we're going to plant a lot of switchgrass. Well, it's monocultural agriculture, and that gets dangerous, or your inputs change, or other things happen. So you want to have a technology that can do a lot of different conversions, or a number of technologies that can convert different feedstocks that grow well in different parts of the country, consistent with what you have for water availability, what you have for just all the other things that go along with it. Where possible, again, you start thinking really big. And Rob alluded to the infrastructure piece of this. If we start putting 80 billion gallons of biofuel, which is the 30 by 30 if you allow the growth to go in, into the marketplace in the United States, you're not going to do it with truck. You're not going to do it with rail. You're not going to do it with barge. Not where the major parts of the resource are grown versus where most of the resource is used, which is on the two coasts. I was, as a former Californian, and sometimes wish to be a Californian again. Houston isn't the best weather. You look, California's the second largest gasoline-consuming country in the world after the United States. So you think about where things are used. 1 in 8 Americans is a Californian, by the way. It's some people think that's a good stat, and some people think that's a scary stat. But you have the folks I-95 and east. You have the folks on the West Coast. And if you're trying to truck or rail that out there, and I don't know how much you guys deal with rail every day, but I'll tell you, capacity is pretty tight right now. And you want to go from 5 billion gallons to 80 billion gallons. You want something that integrates with manufacturing. At least part of the stream needs to integrate with manufacturing distribution. You want to work inside of the existing infrastructure. Recognize I have a vested interest. We own a bunch of that infrastructure. But you want to work in it because there's a lot of efficiencies that come from it. You need something that makes a compatible market fuel. There's technologies that go to gasoline, to diesel. If engine technologies change, and they will, which changes fuel demand, and you get to something an HCCI engine, when we get the fuel engine technology and future technology, we'll go through that. But that engine uses something like low-octane gasoline or low-cetane diesel, probably. Very different fuel and very different than what we make today. So you're going to have to look at engine technology and the fuel molecules you make and how that integrates. And then you have to look at sustainability, and then you have to look at economics. In reality, when you get to maturity, and if we do 30 by 30, if that's an agreed-on target, you're not going to want to have a large amount of subsidy into that industry. It would be a substantial drain. So you're going to say, how do we raise technologies that can support that? So we sat down, and this is actually, we sat on a whiteboard and said, what are all the different technologies that we think are viable? And we started out with a much broader list than this and came down. These are ones that we think are both technically viable and have a shot at being economically viable. And we went from three basic feed sources, distilled down fats and oils. There's three different pathways we've looked at there. You're familiar with biodiesel, which is fatty acid methyl ester, and biodiesel will be a part of the future. Cracking, we can take any fat or oil and basically put it in FCC and make gasoline. The weird thing there is you get different sorts of volumetric yields, and probably there's some issues around that if we worked off the existing fats and oil. Where that might play in is if we get into massive amounts of algal oil or other sorts of sources of oils and triglycerides that you may say, okay, that technology fits in. It probably doesn't fit today. Hydrogenation makes a product called renewable diesel. That's where we take a fat or oil, we mix it or neat feed it into a hydrotreater and make diesel fuel, D975, EN590 diesel fuel. It's a technology that's actually commercializing in Europe. We have run commercial scale at our Whitegate refinery in Ireland. BP has announced they're going to do it at Bulwer in Australia. Petrobras has announced they're going to do it in Brazil. And Nippon Oil has announced they're going to do it in Japan and in other parts of Asia. Interesting technology, makes a totally integrated fuel, and we think is a technology that needs to be pursued. You look at starches and oils, you have ethanol. You have the higher alcohols piece, which is pretty interesting. I think that my colleague from BP will talk about their biobutanol. I would assume they will. Interesting pathway, higher alcohols, polyols, and things like that are a fun way to go. And then direct conversion from sugar to hydrocarbon. There's some work by Huber and Dumasek. Dumasek at Wisconsin, Huber, who's now at UMass, where they've directly converted sugars to hydrocarbons, gasoline and distillate, or diesel sorts of products. And then there's a direct biomass conversion pieces, whether it's to be cellulosic ethanol, whether it be digestion, making gaseous products, whether through pyrolysis, or through biomass to liquids. All of these will probably play a part if our target is something like 30 by 30. Because all of these bring different sources of feedstock into the marketplace. Now, I'm going to get wonky. This is a fun place to do it. So let's talk about the RFS language versus the implementation. RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard, part of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, is actually product neutral, which is good. that in our vision, which is, should be a balanced, let's look at it and explore different sources, it's product neutral in definition. And regulators and regulations need to try not to pick winners and losers. Bob talked about that from the agriculture side. It's also in the conversion or the finished molecule side. Ethanol, biodiesel, and cellulosic, they're in because they've got an existing infrastructure. They're not bad technologies. There's nothing wrong with them, but they're not necessarily the long-term winner. They're a part of the solution. They're not the solution. And they receive different sorts of subsidies, and those subsidies encumber my economics when I look at what I want to invest in. I may think a technology is superior or has some advantages, but I look at the economics versus a subsidized product, and I say, wow, I'm not a charity. I can't run that sort of product. I'm looking at a feedstock that comes in at 80, 90 bucks a barrel, and I'm making a product that sells for 60. It doesn't work. So you have to look at those sorts of competitions that go on and say, how do I make it so that we work off of a level playing field? How do we let all flowers bloom? Because they're all pretty, but you want to have a rich garden. Also, how you talk sets the stage. Think back a couple years ago. Hydrogen. Boy, hydrogen was the coolest thing in the world. We're all going to be in the hydrogen economy, and a bunch of us are investing millions and millions of dollars in hydrogen. There was a whole lot of hype. The VCs poured a ton of money, a lot of startups in hydrogen. They didn't make any money. They ran out, and actually now a lot of them are investing in biofuels. And so I call it a hydrogen hangover. It's hard to get certain hydrogen technology funded, but those of us who are in this for the long haul say, really, the goals haven't changed. Freedom Car and Fuels Partnership, which is a DOE activity, we have some very specific goals of what we want to look at. We're supposed to go back and say, okay, by 2015, we have to make a recommendation to the president that says, yes, we can commercialize hydrogen, it looks like this, or we don't think we can. We haven't changed our goals. We haven't changed our long-term investment patterns, but the hype, people thought it was going to save the world. Then people say, well, it's dropped off. It's still a legitimate long-term thing to look at. But how you frame the argument in the discussion really kind of drives behaviors that you may not intend. So we say a balanced vision. It needs to be the vision when we look at biofuels. It's going to take a lot of different pathways because you want to take different sources of biofuels that grow in different parts of the world or feedstocks that grow in different parts of the world and different parts of the country and convert them through different technologies to make fuel. Every one of the pathways I talked about is full of uncertainties about how do they get to scale, how scalable can they be, where are their carrying capacities, and those sorts of things. All of them have unintended consequences, every single one of them. They're all full of entrenched interests, and we always self-identify. We are an entrenched interest. They're all less efficient than petroleum today. Petroleum is incredibly energy dense. And we've had 100 years to build a very, very efficient infrastructure. The petroleum infrastructure is really pretty solid. So you're going to have to say, all right, how do we work our way through this? And the other thing hanging out there is carbon. You have to anticipate that we're going to be looking at a carbon-constrained world with what's going on. So how will that influence each one of these different pathways? Some are better for carbon, some are not. How does that carbon value get put into the marketplace? So all those things out there and how that plays through the economics is interesting. So we'd say the important thing is to facilitate market neutrality. Avoid distortive incentives. Where they're used, insert the biomass, and insert the biomass times a conversion piece to say, okay, how do I make sure that if I'm going to go into a marketplace or incent the fuel type, I'm going into distillate, anything that goes into distillate should get a similar sort of incentive. So these different technologies can have their way to explore and grow. It's very important we do that. We need to support the development of alternative technologies. You think about our friends at NREL and DOE. If you've ever sat in a DOE meeting, there's good funding going into different areas, and you get to sit down and talk with them. One of the banes to their existence is earmarks. I mean, when you do a science program, you want to pick the people who do the best science. You don't want to pick the person who got the earmark. And so you have to support the development, and you have to support it in a way that allows the scientists to be scientists. Broaden the language. Talk about biofuels instead of just biodiesel or ethanol. And be technology neutral. And let people understand there's strengths and weaknesses. There are unintended consequences to anything we choose. So that's it. I look forward to your questions at the end.
Very comprehensive, and hopefully quite a bit of food for thought for later. Hopefully you're writing down questions. We'll give you a minute or two here as we swap speakers. We're next going to invite Reed Detchen to come up. Reed is, of course, with the Energy Futures Coalition and has been one of the prime movers behind 25 by 25, and he's going to talk to us about that.
Well, thank you, Doug. This is really an unusual experience for me. I've been thinking about and talking about biofuels and bioenergy for probably 20 years now. And I can't recall a previous session where I wasn't just busily scribbling down all the things I had to rebut. This is really something. When I find myself agreeing with ConocoPhillips in Iowa State wholeheartedly, I'm feeling in a very strange place. And you all ought to feel in a very strange place. Not quite as much yesterday. AEI had a conference on biofuels yesterday at 9 o'clock in the morning the day after the election. And the room was full for that, and I was thinking, this is really different. Either this is Washington and people get out of bed at 9 o'clock after an election to go talk about ethanol, or this is really hot, and I think it's a little bit of both. But let me just stipulate that while I'm happy to knock down misinformation and disinformation, as Doug referred to, so far we've been blessedly free of that. And it's also a little unusual. You'll see from my bio that I'm not the technical guy, and yet usually at a conference I am the technical guy because at least I've thought about some of this stuff. So what I'm going to do is take us in a little different path, non-technical in many ways, because we are at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I want to put this into a little bit of context about what this might mean in terms of thinking about our national security. A brief word of a background. The Energy Future Coalition, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a public policy initiative that's foundation-supported. The founding fathers were Tim Wirth and Boyden Gray and John Podesta, and that'll give you a sense of the bipartisan cast of it. We try to work across sectors, and we have three objectives or three challenges that we want to take on: oil dependence, climate change, and access to modern energy services by the world's poor. And we feel that both U.S. and global energy policy has failed to address those topics for quite some time. And we've had some success, and we want to have continued success in changing the conversation about energy to take on those very serious problems. We try to stay within politically doable bounds. We put out an overview report based on recommendations of a half a dozen working groups we put together a few years ago, and we have supported the 25 by 25 initiative through a group of farmer leaders that have really gotten the ag community focused on the energy opportunity with a great deal of success and a lot of momentum and excitement in the farm community, but also broadening out to endorsement by the three auto companies, by the National Association of Counties, various entities. And if you're interested, and I hope you are interested, there's a nice website, 25x25.org, where you can get all the information on that. And I put up the last line in tribute to Washington. How many letters and numbers can I put on the same line? I was the principal deputy assistant secretary for energy efficiency and renewable energy in the previous Bush administration. That's what that means. So we see two drivers of disruptive change in the energy area. One is Of course, the insecurity of our oil resources, and the other is climate change. And really where we try to set a different path is that most people who approach these issues do so with justifiable alarm, but you end up getting a kind of a doom and gloom, peak oil, glaciers melting, the world is coming to an end view that we actually think is not helpful. We think that there are enormous opportunities, economic opportunities, that come out of the inevitable transition that we're beginning, and that's what we want to be focused on. We think that the costs of this transition have been exaggerated and the benefits have been overlooked. We're going to have technological innovation. This is in many ways analogous to the IT revolution or the telecom revolution, where new technologies are going to fundamentally transform an existing industry and create new opportunities. We're going to have economic growth in the United States and job creation because we'll be using domestic resources, and we'll have benefits to public health and the environment. So just to review a couple of very familiar slides, and I'll do this quickly. This is EIA's oil price projection from last December. The red line, if you can see it, is the projection they made then. The blue line is the projection they had made the previous year. So in 1 year, they said, oops, I guess we missed, and they raised their entire price curve by $20 over the next 30 years. Just a little adjustment. And with apologies to Howard I saw in the back of the room, Howard Grunspecht, who probably got the realism into the thing. I don't want to cast any aspersions here. I think clearly the upper line is more likely to be the case than the lower line. And who knows, maybe it'll be further adjusted this December because we've been in a range mostly above that red line for the past 12 months. But I think that the important part of this is that at that red line, biofuels compete economically. If that red line is true, this is not a subsidized industry that we're looking at. This is an industry that, when we get over the many hurdles that Bob and Lou laid out appropriately, doable but nonetheless difficult hurdles, that can compete at that price and maybe considerably below. So why do we have to do it? Well, nobody in this room probably needs to be told that all the oil's in the Middle East. So duh. And as the president recognized, and I think Doug said to me when I came in, gee, this is really a great moment. You're bipartisan. We are bipartisan. Yeah, the Democrats are in a stronger position now, but the president has shown leadership on this. Andy Karsner, who runs the program at the Department of Energy, is very aggressive. I think Sam Bodman, who's the relatively new energy secretary, totally gets this and sees this as a legacy item. So I think this is where we can all play together. So what are we shooting at here? You know, there's a lot of talk. There's always been a lot of talk about energy independence going back to Nixon. And I think we need to think about what energy independence means. I think that the idea, which is often the way the media characterizes it, is we totally end our oil imports, we completely produce all of our transportation fuels domestically, A, is not realistic, and B, is not really thinking the problem through very clearly. Ed Rendell, governor of Pennsylvania, used a phrase at one of our events that I thought was the right way to think about it. We're talking about political independence. How can we get to a point where oil is no longer has no longer the role in our economy that the countries who produce it can use it for political or economic blackmail? So the goal is not can we get to 100% self-sufficiency, but can we start to produce enough alternatives that we can, whether it's 25 by 25 or 30 by 30, that we can start to have some flexibility in the system. We can deal with, we can have less impact of price spikes and people in the market. But I mean, consumers are in the whiplash position on oil prices. If they end up having choices at the pump, that's going to be a fundamentally empowering step that is clearly beneficial from any kind of a market perspective. And then the last point here, of course, is that when you say 25 by 25 or 30 by 30, 25 or 30% of what? Yes, EIA has its projections, and they're perfectly good projections based on current patterns. But if some of the very interesting opportunities on the efficiency side can be brought to bear in terms of lightweight materials that could make cars less demanding of fuel, in terms of moving toward greater use of electricity in the system, so you have plug-in hybrids that are running on biofuels, you can change the dynamic of what target you're trying to reach and make perhaps even higher goals practical. So, again, what I think we need to think about is not total independence, but what's achievable in terms of flexibility, in terms of introducing competition to the market, and in terms of diversity of supply. This is a very famous quote from Winston Churchill about diversity of oil supplies, and it's usually been taken to mean, reasonably enough, we don't want to just get our oil from Saudi Arabia. Let's get it from Canada and Mexico and Norway and so on and so forth. But I think that with the world market for oil tightening, with the Chinese demand, the Indian demand, putting us in a position where we're never again going to have, in my opinion, the kind of surpluses we had over the last 20 years that drive prices down to very low levels, we have to think about variety not just of where we're getting our oil, but variety of our transportation fuel sources. This is not an issue of diversity of oil supply, but diversity of fuel supply. So what can biofuels deliver? Some of this is familiar with to you, but current production, I guess, is actually 4.5 billion gallons. It's ramping up very rapidly. Only a couple of years ago, it was about 2. So we've doubled in a very short standard time frame. And in response, in part to the change in the oil prices, in part to the legislation, the renewable fuel standard, the industry has gone into an absolute binge of new construction. I think that this RFS standard will be met not in 2012, but probably 2008. And so already Congress is talking about doubling that, perhaps by 2015. I think that it's possible, and I think this is reasonably approximate to what Bob said, for the corn industry to produce 15 to 20 billion gallons. At least that's what they say. It might be a little too high relative to their competing uses, but let's say that that's the neighborhood, and then we get into, well, what are we trying to do here? Currently, we're using 140 billion gallons of gasoline. Because ethanol has less energy content than gasoline, that's like 200 billion gallons of ethanol. So I mean, if you do the math and you work it backward, if you want to see what the target is for replacement, you'd have to get 200 billion gallons of ethanol in order to replace 140 billion gallons of gasoline. So if you think in terms of, well, what's 25 or 30% of that, you're into the 50, 60 billion gallons. Clearly a lot more than corn can do. I don't think anybody disagrees with that, whether they're in the corn business or not. Just to support the points made earlier about the necessity of moving to cellulose. But let me just say one thing. I didn't even get a chance to have the myth stated so that I could knock it down. But you hear about energy balance, which is a complete red herring. And we can talk about energy balance if we want. But that's about fossil energy balance. It's really a greenhouse gas argument. And it's an important discussion in terms of greenhouse gases. But if what we're thinking about in this room, in this building, is our security, our petroleum requirements, our dependence, that's what to focus on, and no matter where you are on the scale, skeptic, non-skeptic, there's no disagreement that ethanol takes very little petroleum to use. It's an easy way to think about it. Even with the energy content difference, 100 gallons of gas of 100 gallons of ethanol replace about 60 gallons of gasoline. That's a pretty easy way to think about it. We had a different slide about the Oak Ridge study, which is the biomass resource potential of the United States. This is a projection. This is the so-called billion-ton studies. You can see the bottom line actually goes to 1.3 billion. This is what Oak Ridge believes is realistically feasible to produce without having a serious impact on our existing food, fiber, and feed markets. By 2030, they don't say this is what we're doing today, but it gives you a sense of the order of magnitude. And I think that, in fact, understates the forest potential for the reasons that I think it was Lou said about the Southeast. So when you think about the problem about how much you can do, thinking about yield is the place to be. A lot of the projections about what we can and cannot do are based on current yields. Lou referred to, I think it was Lou, the series work about improving, or as Bob, all right, well, great minds thought about this. This yield thing is really important to understand because it's true that we've been improving corn yields by 2% a year basically since the turn of the century, and this continues to go, and we're going to continue to produce more corn. But we haven't turned any of that research energy onto these new crops, and the ability to bring them up the curve much faster, I think, is considerable. If you can get to those higher yields, it's eminently practical to do any of these goals. Then they sort of are an increasing order of magnitude. Secretary Bodman has set a 30 by 30 goal. Oak Ridge, as we just saw, that those numbers equivalent to one-third of current U.S. Oil petroleum consumption. Aspen Institute convened a panel that I participated on where 100 billion gallons of ethanol was set as a nominal target. And Vinod Khosla, who's one of the real evangelists in the field and putting many millions of dollars into investments, he thinks that we can completely eliminate the use of oil in the motor vehicle fleet. So then the question is, okay, those are all very lofty goals, but how do we get there and how soon? I think that time is an important factor here. Again, if you're thinking about legislative goals and so forth, when people say we're gonna reduce oil consumption by X amount by Y date, this is not a nimble industry because you've got 200 million vehicles, you've got a very well established and highly efficient petroleum infrastructure, as Lou said. This takes time. We have to recognize it takes time. We're growing this industry very fast, but it's going to take time. So, if you think about corn ethanol, maybe 12 to 15 billion gallons by 2015 is a reasonable goal. Cellulose is the big kicker here. How soon does that enter the market? One thing I want to say about the corn thing is that we have to recognize that a transition to a different fuel is going to be lumpy, and we're going to have bumps along the way. Last year, we had, or this current calendar year, we had a bump because the oil industry shifted all of its oxygenate use from MTBE into ethanol, and that created a demand that the industry was not at that moment capable of responding to. Building all these plants, I think that will be solved very quickly. Very similarly, this new building now is putting pressure on the corn supply. That's going to bump up corn prices on a temporary basis, but you can bet as much as you want that corn farmers will be planting a lot more acreage next year in corn, and we're going to have a different kind of a bump down where ethanol prices will fall, corn prices will fall, people will be alarmed the other direction. This is going to be a bumpy road, and we just have to recognize that's how it goes. Cellulose, briefly, I think the DOE expects to have first-generation plants operating by 2008, not their own, but supporting private investment. Certainly their target is to be competitive, at least as I understand it, with corn ethanol by 2012. And then you would, if that's the case, then again, thinking about the transition you have to go through here, the investment would lead to substantial growth in the latter part of the next decade. One of the points that Lou made about California is worth thinking about in this context, because one of the things that happens when you move from corn to cellulose is you change the geographic distribution of the crops. We know where you can grow corn, which is in the Midwest, but you can grow cellulose practically anywhere in the United States. And they will be different crops. Some of them in California, for example, it'll be ag waste, ag residues, a tremendous supply of that. You could grow energy cane in California. So not to diminish the fact that we're going to have infrastructure challenges, but some of that will be ameliorated by the fact that you'll start to be producing ethanol closer to where the markets are than you are currently with the Midwest. So when you think about introducing a new fuel, what do you have to think about? You have to think about fuel. You have to think about how you're going to get that to the customers. What's the infrastructure and have the vehicles to use it? And so this is why it gets lumpy, because each of these pieces move forward at different rates. And as you think about that, you have to think about it in terms of whether you're going to use a price driver, you're going to use some sort of a regulatory driver, or some combination thereof. This is somewhat similar to what Lou was saying. We have some significant constraints. We have very few pumps out there. We have no ethanol pipelines. Will this yield to time and demand? I think so, but not quickly and easily. We have to also resolve, and this is what Bob was saying, harvesting hundreds of millions of tons of biomass and getting it to plants is a non-trivial matter, both in terms of the harvest cycle, in terms of the physical transport. This needs further work. We need to have the vehicles on the road. We have 6 million vehicles on the road already because of a fuel economy credit that the automakers get, but out of 200 million vehicle fleet, that's less than compelling to a gas station thinking about putting in a new pump. So that's going to have to continue to go. But I think we are approaching a virtuous cycle there. We hear talk that Walmart will start putting in E85 pumps, and you'll start to – I think they could control the price a little better in the market. You might start to see a lot of $1.50 ethanol in the market. People are going to say, how do I get some of that? Well, I go get a flexible fuel vehicle, more flexible fuel vehicles, more pumps. It'll start to play in a positive way. I think the most important inhibitor right now goes back to that earlier EIA projection of oil prices. Is it the blue line or is it the red line? And if I'm going to invest $300 million in a new cellulosic ethanol biorefinery, what assurance do I have that it is the higher line and not the lower line? What's going to be the future of oil? And so I think that as we think about, as we do in Washington, what kind of policy instruments could be applied to this problem, I think that that's probably the most important area to think about. One of the things that Vinod Khosla has been promoting that I think has a lot of merit is thinking about making the subsidies countercyclical, such that, as I said, at that higher line, at $50, $60 a barrel of oil, ethanol today does not need a subsidy. So why are we paying it? That's a good question. But clearly, if it were to go down to $20 or $30, it would need a subsidy to compete with oil. And if we're thinking about growing a nascent domestic industry, protecting, for example, against the possibility of predatory pricing by OPEC, it's not out of the question. How do we give them assurance that we're in this for the long term? I think we could make the ethanol credit permanent, but we make it tied to the price of oil such that it gets paid in full at, say, $30, and it goes away at $60. Why not? It'll save us money in the near term, and it'll give them assurance in the future. And what's good for the goose, why not apply the same thing to oil? I mean, what in the world are we giving oil business subsidies right now for at $60 a barrel? Why don't we tie that to the price of oil? And let's do that up and down the same way. That's kind of a market orientation or market standard kind of context. But then you can think about regulatory paths. We have the renewable fuel standard. I'll mention one other. About a quarter of every gallon of gasoline is a set of toxic compounds called aromatics, benzene, xylene, and toluene. And the purpose of these is to provide octane. Well, biofuels provide octane. If we could start to reduce the toxic content of gasoline with very good public health benefits, you would also be creating an assured market for biofuels. There are some logistical transitional hurdles to that, but in the beginning, And Lou would probably, and possibly Adam might rebut me on this because they're probably more expert, but from what we understand, at the early stages of that transition, it actually saves money for the refineries because these compounds have a market value outside the refinery. Going, I think, to one of the previous points again, R&D, we're talking about taking on a challenge that involves the world's biggest industry, involves our entire transportation sector. It involves our economic and national security. Involves, for example, upwards of $250 billion of our trade deficit this year. Why are we investing $30, $40, and $50 million against that level of challenge? I think we're off at least by a factor of two and maybe a factor of 10 of what we ought to be investing relative both to the risk we face, peak oil, sudden disruptions, economic harm, military risk, but also in terms of the opportunity for creating a domestic transportation fuels industry that would create literally millions of new jobs, that would revitalize rural America and have significant environmental benefits. What would we do? We need to be thinking about our R&D posture if, you know, the old line that Churchill used on his memos in World War II was action this day. You know, what if we did have an incident and the price of oil was $100, $150? Are we going to say, well, we're in the middle of a 10-year research program, or we'll get there eventually, or are we going to be prepared to respond to that with fast action? I think that that's what we need to think about, and that's the way we ought to build our R&D budget. I'll close with a slide I'm stealing from Vinod Khosla, who says, this is a Darwinian IQ test. Should we feed Mideast terrorism or Midwest farmers? Should we import expensive gasoline or use cheaper ethanol? Should we create new farm jobs or should we help out Middle East oil tycoons? Should we use fossil fuels or green fuels? Should we invest in Anwar oil rigs or prairie grass fields? Should we have gasoline-only cars or cars with fuel choices? I think that the opportunity is there to go to the latter choices and to have a brighter future in our transportation fuels industry. Oil will do very well, thank you, as long as any of us are is alive. But I think we have an opportunity to do some benefit for our economy, for our environment, and for our security. Thank you.
Thank you, Reed, for a very provocative, broad-reaching set of comments, and hopefully that that also spurs a number of questions from the audience later, and as well as maybe a couple of myths hidden in there that at least I'll take the opportunity when it comes later. But we're next going to welcome Adam Schubert. He's the U.S. Strategy Manager for BP Alternative Fuels, another corporate perspective, but also a global one. And so we'll turn the podium to Adam.
Thank you, Doug, and good morning. What I'd like to do today is share some thoughts with you, giving you a short summary of BP's experience and approach to biofuels. From the evidence available today, we're convinced that biofuels will make a major strategic contribution to global energy supplies in this century. However, we believe that the potential of biofuels will not be fulfilled merely by doing more of the same, but will require the development of successive generations of increasingly powerful biocomponents. And our latest activities are focused on bringing this all about. Know that you've covered a lot of the context in detail, both in prior sessions and the earlier speakers today, and we tend to come to violent agreement about the basic premise for biofuels. There's only one fuel that addresses the four big questions on this slide: demand for transport fuels, concern for environment, both local air quality as well as greenhouse gas emissions, energy security, and growing markets for the agriculture sector. Nothing else attacks all of those. For BP, expanding our biofuels activity is a logical step on the environmental journey we've been on for nearly a decade. Some of you may recall that BP made some headlines in the 90s when we publicly acknowledged the need to take precautionary efforts to avert the risks of global climate change. We immediately followed that statement with action. Our goal was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from our own operations using the Kyoto benchmark of a 10% reduction from 1990 levels by 2010. In fact, we achieved that by the end of 2001. We now have an ongoing efficiency challenge and program in place, spending nearly $500 million to maintain that momentum and keep reducing our own energy consumption. However, we've also looked outside our own operations, aware that climate change is a global issue, and as a supplier of hydrocarbons, we have a responsibility to find ways to curb emissions from our end users. So, we've supported research into various aspects of climate change. That's included an influential piece of work carried out at Princeton, also supported by Ford Motor Company, which has analyzed the various options for moving forward towards a low-carbon economy. This has included energy efficiency, carbon capture and storage, and renewables. It quantified the contributions that each could make. By way of example, the Princeton team calculated that to reduce global carbon emissions by 1 billion tons by the 2050s, using ethanol as produced today would require a 50-fold increase in production, representing 1/6 of the world's cropland. Last year, we took a major step toward putting a number of these low-carbon alternatives into action in the power generation sector by launching a new business called BP Alternative Energy, which is investing $8 billion over the next several years in generating power from solar, wind, gas, and hydrogen. So our biofuels activity launched this year really comprises the next logical step: applying what we know about low-carbon technologies to the transport sector. As you may expect, we've reviewed all the options for low-carbon transport fuels, and we've reached some conclusions that particularly the ones that can really make a difference in the long term are biofuels and hydrogen. BP continues to participate in a number of hydrogen initiatives, but there are a number of well-documented issues there in terms of manufacture, storage, and distribution, not to mention activity on the vehicle side, that make this a long-term proposition. Biofuels, however, are with us today and have the potential to be scaled up fairly rapidly. Much of that potential speed comes from how we can maximize use of existing vehicles and existing infrastructure. This chart comes from the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, and it shows the significance of biofuels. It shows how transport-related CO2 emissions would rise between now and 2050 in a business-as-usual environment, the upper line, and then looks at how that total can be cut back by using various alternatives. Switching to diesel fuel and using hybrids make limited but very worthwhile contributions. Fuel cells start to become material much later on this time frame. But the big early contribution, and by far the largest contribution over this full time frame, comes from biofuels. This is why BP is in. There we go. This is why BP is already involved in biofuels in various ways. Last year, for example, we were the largest biofuels blender in the U.S. fuel pool, blending a total of 575 million gallons, which is well in excess of our share of the gasoline market. We added 20 new markets last year and evaluated the potential of biodiesel with selected customers. We continue to add a number of new markets this year. In Europe, we were the first major to introduce 5% biodiesel blends in Germany. In Australia, as Lou mentioned, we're producing renewable diesel fuel from tallow at one of our refineries, and we'll be supplying ethanol to retails, and we are supplying ethanol to retail sites in Queensland. Over the next 2 years, we expect to provide more than half of Australia's biofuels target of 350 billion liters, million liters. We have, in addition, a research project in India, which I'll talk a bit more about later. In Asia, we've joined the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which aims to prevent undesirable consequences from rapid development of this high-energy biofuel blend stock. So, today we're operating at scale in what is a small-scale industry. Realizing the full potential of biofuels, however, requires that we focus on creating a large-scale industry. And as an integrated energy company, we're used to being involved along the full value chain, constantly thinking about the risks and opportunities at each stage. In terms of feedstocks, the imperative is to create a situation where we have sustainable, ongoing production of feedstock. In terms often used in sustainable development circles, we want to use the interest on nature. We don't want to eat into the capital. This in turn means that we need to diversify sources of feedstocks, a modern update to the Winston Churchill quote, with a goal of maximizing the contribution of biofuels to the mix. To satisfy this need for increasing volumes and diversity of supply, we expect that there will be substantial growth in international trade of biofuels and feedstocks. This will, of course, result in debate about the appropriate balance between domestic sources of supply and maximizing the penetration of biodiesels into the fuel mix. We also need to minimize diversion of food crops into fuel. This is going to be particularly important in the developing world, where all available cropland really needs to be used for producing food. In the conversion and distribution stages of the chain, we want to minimize the carbon footprint of our activity, maximize the use of our existing infrastructure, and provide room for our industry to continue to find cost efficiencies. The type of cost efficiencies we've put into the hydrocarbon business, apply them in the biofuels business as well. With the end user, we want to minimize local air quality and greenhouse gas impacts. We want to provide for the existing fleet and existing vehicle technologies so as to create the widest market for biofuels as quickly as possible, rather than moving towards specially designed vehicles that will take many, many years to have a substantial penetration of the fleet. At the same time, we need to continue to meet the customer's needs for reliability, performance, and affordability. Now, if we look at keep these factors in mind, we see two things. First, we've made a lot of progress. Today's conventional biofuels are being built at scale and represent a very positive first step. But secondly, they have limitations. and I believe that will prevent them from fulfilling the full potential of biomass as a source of fuel. There is competition from food use. There are challenges to availability at scale. The reductions in greenhouse gases are currently modest, where an ethanol, for example, is typically blended at 10 volume percent. And there are environmental issues surrounding feedstock, such as palm oil, where there is a danger of uncontrolled destruction of virgin rainforest. Ethanol, the most widely used biofuel today, is very useful, but is not ideal. It has a relatively low energy density, around two-thirds that of gasoline, and that affects fuel economy directly. It has a significant impact on the vapor pressure of gasoline, which means refineries have to retool and lose yield in order to prevent unfavorable environmental impacts. They have water solubility issues that prevent gasoline-ethanol blends from moving by pipeline today or by ship, and that adds complexity to our distribution and adds cost. Today's biodiesel components also face challenges in terms of stability, resistance to deposit formation in engines, and low temperature performance properties. These are likely to restrict levels to 5 or 10% in current diesel vehicles. We've had a few numbers put up on the availability of corn for producing ethanol. Here's another take, which comes up with a fairly similar number. Looking at the various studies, we're trying to estimate what is the biggest possible amount you could have, and we estimate corn production rising to maybe 300 million tons in 10 years, of which half goes to food and feed. If we assume that there's no exports and no corn is used for anything else, that gets you to about 17 billion gallons of ethanol. So far in the U.S., wheat hasn't made sense for economically for producing ethanol. It is used in Europe, and that can potentially add another 5 billion gallons if you ignore the economics. But realistically, you know, other than using the corn that's already going to ethanol and drying up exports, taking corn out of other markets gets to be increasingly difficult. Some benefits from yield improvement. Perhaps we can only come up with 10 billion gallons, probably a number higher than that. In any case, we are above the 7.5 billion gallons required by 2012 for a renewable fuel standard, but it's still, even the most optimistic case we put out here, 22 billion gallons, that's 14% of the U.S. gasoline supply at the very most. In our view, we need to set our sights much higher than that. As I said before, more of the same won't get us where we need to go. We believe that 30% penetration of biocomponents into the global road transport fuels market over the next 2 or 3 decades is possible. It's an ambitious but a potentially achievable goal. However, it requires that a new generation of biofuels with new feedstocks and processes supplement the existing ones. In terms of feedstocks, we know that corn at around 240 gallons per acre of ethanol has a lower yield than feedstocks such as sugarcane. On the oil-based additives for diesel, we know that a crop such as Jatropha or palm oil offers far higher yields of biodiesel than soy. Sugarcane may not be relevant in the U.S. context, but there's certainly scope to explore woody crops, straws and residues, lignocellulosic conversion, which offers the prospect of using the entire plant, stalks, stems, and leaves, with yields ranging up to perhaps 1,200 gallons of ethanol per acre. In terms of reducing greenhouse gases, Biofuels can achieve anywhere from a 20 to 90% reduction, depending on their energy content and the amount of carbon emitted during the cultivation and conversion process. The major wins are to be had through using less energy-intensive cultivation and conversion, through more powerful feedstock crops, and through use of all of the plant, straw, leaves, stalks. There are other potential feedstocks with high yields as well. Another key step may well be to look at non-food crops, crops that can be grown on more marginal land, but which nevertheless can use existing conversion technology and therefore be implemented in the short term without conflict with food requirements. One possibility is to use crops such as Jatropha, which produces a non-edible oil and is hardy enough to survive on relatively poor land. However, there are important questions still to be answered, including those around commercial and environmental viability of this option, particularly when they're being cultivated on land that currently is not being used for food. To study these questions, BP has set up a structured Jatropha demonstration program in India in cooperation with the Energy Resources Institute, or TERI. In BP, our activity is very much directed toward enabling these next-generation biofuels to emerge. Firstly, we have set up a dedicated biofuels business, a single team to coordinate all biofuels activities within the group. Second, we have announced our plans to invest $500 million over 10 years in establishing and maintaining an Energy Biosciences Institute at a leading academic institution. The location still to be announced. This will bring together a team of around 150 researchers and scientists applying their disciplines to the needs of the energy industry. Our vision is that this institute will lead in developing new molecules, creating new technologies that enable greater proportions of crops to be used for fuel production, and exploring new species of plant that increase the yield of fuel energy available per acre of cropland. We hope that it will answer some of the outstanding questions that you are raising in this series. Its researchers will be energy bioscientists who can raise the level of activity and deepen understanding in the emerging scientific inquiry around biofuels. The remit of EBI will range beyond transport fuels as well, looking at other applications of bioscience to energy, such as enhancing coal-based methane production and carbon sequestration. The other major development this year has been our announcement of a partnership with DuPont, bringing together their expertise in biotech production with our knowledge of fuels markets. One of the first target molecules in that partnership will be biobutanol, a first step in moving toward a new generation of fuels. Biobutanol is derived from the same feedstocks as ethanol and is produced with similar technology. We believe it can overcome some of the challenges faced by ethanol, either through use as a component alongside of ethanol or on its own right. It's easily blended into gasoline. It can use existing infrastructure with little modification. It can move in pipelines. It has potential to be used at higher blend concentrations than ethanol without needing to modify vehicles. And it has a higher energy content, closer to that of gasoline, thereby providing consumer with better fuel economy. Let me conclude with a few remarks on policy. As I have shown, we believe that the key to the future of biofuels lies in innovating to develop successive generations of biofuels with new feedstocks, new molecules, and new conversion processes. Given the potential that exists for step change, as well as incremental change, We believe that policy needs to encourage advances at all stages in the value chain and not simply incentivize more of the same. The task now is to create a dynamic and innovative market in which different types of biofuel can be tested and the winners commercialized. It's therefore important that regulations target desired outcomes, allowing the market to pick winners and losers, and rather than incentivizing specific solutions. In our view, that means that intervention geared to emissions reductions or the quantity of fuel energy replaced, rather than mandated volumes of particular products. It means supporting sourcing from sustainable and responsible production routes. It means regulatory mechanisms which apply equally to all, and it means maintaining flexibility. For example, avoiding fixed per gallon markets because we don't know what our future researches will bring. If policymakers proceed across these lines, our industry will respond, and I believe that biofuels will be a material supplement for transport fuels in the medium term. To conclude, we see biofuels as one of the key solutions to environmental and security concerns over the next 20 to 30 years. Biotechnology has brought major advances into the field of medicine. We believe applying it to energy field can bring major advances in that area as well. We have not only the responsibility to act, but I believe we have the ability to act. We look forward to working with others in industry, government, academia, and beyond to enable that new, sustainable industry to emerge. Thank you.
Thank you. Even some more food for thought, particularly if one starts to think about very long-term solutions, and I think we need to keep that in perspective. As we've done in each of our previous sessions, we've asked a commenter to think between the lines a little bit, think about what the different presentations and the different perspectives mean. We've certainly heard things today all the way spanning from ag policy and ag supply through conversion delivery as well as international relations and certainly the issues of security and environment and energy policy. So we've asked Eldon Bays to be our commenter today and provide a few remarks at this stage, and then we'll turn to questions and answers. Eldon, as you know from the bios, is an ASME fellow on the Senate Ag Committee. So Eldon, please.
Thank you, Doug, and it's a real honor and pleasure to be here and to be learning from this panel of speakers. Can't recall if I've played the role of commenter before. It means I didn't have to prepare a presentation, except now during the presentations. I'm not sure if I wouldn't have preferred to prepare one rather than to try to do it on the fly here. Anyway. You get stuck with the fact that it's almost certainly going to be somewhat incoherent. Let me start by mentioning that, as Doug said, I'm a congressional fellow. I'm now on the Senate Ag Committee, and I had the good fortune, I guess I'll call it, to sign up for that position in September on the minority side. So that's an interesting change this week. I think of the role of a congressional fellow as one of bringing good information to the Congress. I also think we can play the role a little bit of a gadfly, in the sense that if we say something out of bounds, they immediately ascribe it to that wacko fellow. So I hope that I'll have some liberty in that regard with that role. The the question that that I hear coming out, I agree with what Reed Detchen said, that this is somewhat remarkable. We're no longer focusing so much on whether we can or should do something with biofuels, or why we shouldn't because it'll never work. Okay, we've all been in lots of meetings and discussions like that. Instead, this we tend to be focused now on what do we do and how do we do it. Okay, and I think that's a very healthy move forward over the last few years. To me, it's a critical area facing the world, and certainly facing the United States. And in terms of what I do after this meeting, it's certainly important for what we do in the Congress. By the way, my background, I think you could tell, is pretty much energy, and I'll be working on energy issues in the Ag Committee. And, of course, the Farm Bill comes up this coming year, and it will have an energy title again. And so I'm very interested in learning more about what should Congress do. Don't mind hearing what could Congress do as well, but the should is the more important, I think. Before coming over, I wrote out a few questions that I hoped would be answered in the meeting, and some of these were answered fairly well, I think, but I thought it might be useful to just read down through my pre-meeting list, and maybe some of the panelists would like to comment on some of these further. Starting off, the renewable fuel standard, everybody agrees we're going to easily meet that ahead of schedule. The cellulosic goal of a billion gallons capacity by 2011, 2012, 2013, that one I think is a little more interesting and maybe a little bit more challenging. One of the questions I wrote down is the technology ready? And a variant of that is how well do we know the technologies, either the feedstock technologies or the conversion technologies? And one way to look at that is in 2025, the production processes we're using for producing ethanol in 2025, will they be fundamentally different from what we're doing today or from what we know today, or will they be fundamentally the same? I think that's a question that, in my mind at least, both on the conversion technologies and on the feedstocks. Okay. In terms of of getting to a billion gallons within, say, 5 years or so, can we build enough plants fast enough? If you think of a 50 million gallon per year plant, that's 20 plants. We've got quite a few groups out there that are saying they want to build plants in the near future. Most of them want to get some federal help to do that. They won't all get that. Okay, what will happen to the others? Will they go forward? Will the feedstocks be produced? By whom and why? And one of the things that keeps going through my mind is, if you want to build a cellulosic ethanol plant, sure, maybe you can lock up contracts for wheat straw in an area, but if you wanted to go to cellulosic with dedicated feedstocks, how do you get a critical mass of the farmers around there to actually commit to providing that feedstock? I think that's a real challenge. And of course, what do we need to do on these fronts? That's sort of the question, I think. Another question in my mind, if you think about the people who are out there building or operating ethanol plants today, if they want to do something more, change their plant, expand their plant, build a new plant, why wouldn't they build another corn plant? Okay, and I think, in fact, the answer today so far is clearly that's what they do. Okay? Or if they decided, well, I want to go the next step, I want to go in the new direction, why would they choose to build a cellulosic ethanol plant based on either corn stover or waste materials or even a dedicated feedstock? Why wouldn't they go instead to co-locating beef production next to their current ethanol plant, because then they can use a digester to of the animal waste, and they can feed the DDGs to the cattle. And in fact, I think quite a few of the plants are thinking about doing that, and some of them are actually doing that. So again, how does that get you onto the cellulosic ethanol path? So those are the kinds of questions that went through my mind ahead of time. I do want to just, I'm not going to try to summarize what these folks said, okay? But I did want to try to highlight a few of the things that I heard that I thought were most interesting. First of all, I thought that Lou Burke and Reed Detchen both gave us a very interesting information on the context that we're facing here, that we're working in. I think Lou's graph that shows those lines way down at the bottom of the graph shows a few stars just above them for the 25 by 25 and the 30 by 30 study, and then shows the EIA projection of the fuels that we're going to be using. That's got to be a very sobering kind of graph to look at, and you immediately begin to ask, well, how do we actually tackle those huge differences on there? I liked Reed Detchen reminding us of the oil context, and the way I think of the world oil situation is that, you know, from 1990 up until about 3-4 years ago, the world always had about, in round numbers, about 5 million barrels per day of spare production capacity. Over the last couple of years, we've only had, in round numbers, about 1 million barrels per day of spare oil production capacity. I think that says a lot, and I don't think that's going to change, and therefore I think markets are going to continue to be volatile and very tight. I really enjoyed seeing all of Adam Schubert's information on the activities they've got going on now, how they view the value chain, and in particular, he emphasized for us the carbon connection, the greenhouse gas connection to this whole issue very well, I think. But with that, I'm going to stop and invite the panelists to comment on these questions if you'd like. I think that's the plan, Doug.
We'll start there and then we'll turn to questions from the audience.
You expect us to remember all of those questions? The one I do remember is the why would somebody cite a cellulosic ethanol plant instead of a cattle feeding operation. Mm-hmm. And the simple answer to that is they couldn't get corn as a feedstock. I didn't put up the plot, I guess, but if I was going to become a net importer of corn, pretty soon there's not a lot of corn to get. So as you, I'm sure, know, in Mead, Nebraska, there's a plant, right, that E3 Bio is, and in Texas there's another one where they're feeding DDGS and having a cattle operation. And it's great. And the net energy of that, being able to supply the energy from that combined operation, taking the animal waste and creating methane, you know, that's going to be a very efficient plant. But you can only have a few of those. And as price for ethanol and other products goes up, people are going to want to have another source. And one of the companies I guess it's not an Iowa company, it's a South Dakota company, but Broin makes dry mill ethanol plants, and they want to know where are they going to sell their next plant. And when there isn't any more corn, so they're looking at, well, all right, so we're going to get in the business of making cellulosic ethanol plants. And they want to make money not just off of building those plants, but the co-products, right? It's a biorefinery. It's not just ethanol. There's a whole stream of products that come out of there. And Lou can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think for, I don't know, the last 15 years or so, gasoline coming out of the oil industry has been not exactly a loss leader, but it's the mass flow that runs through there that pays for the decreased cost of producing a bunch of high-value products, right? Small mass flows where they make a lot of money. and the biorefinery should be the same thing. Take every molecule of that feedstock and make a whole bunch of products. And we're where oil was, I don't know what, 80 years ago or something, maybe.
I'm actually going to not comment on the last thing, but you asked the question, is cellulosic ethanol ready to be a billion gallons by 2012? We don't think it quite is. And part of it comes back to what Rob was saying, is that you really have to get into the whole multiple product stream study. And a lot of that work is going on, and there are folks funding and looking at projects. But the technical and economic risk right now, without a whole lot of support, you wonder, is that a good investment right now? We're investing in cellulosic ethanol development. We're not investing in cellulosic ethanol plants because the technology isn't quite ready to commercialize at that kind of scale, in our opinion, because you've got to get the multiple pathways and the multiple kinds of co-products that will help drive up the economics. Because co-products, we get everything out of a barrel of oil between, you know, what we get from coking, what we get from the light ends and everything in the middle. We put 42 in and we get more than 50 out. In just a volumetric piece, because we have product growth through our system. So until you start driving that technology forward and look at different ways, do you gasify pieces, do you other pieces, and drive it, it's going to be – I don't think it is quite ready to be a billion gallons by 2012. Now, Doug's going to tell me that I'm wrong, and that's his prerogative.
Doug or Adam or
– Well, we might as well just go down the line here. I wanted to talk a little bit about that question, too, and kind of agree and disagree both with Lou. I think what Lou said is generally right. One of the things he said, the investment is not going to occur without a whole lot of support. And I think one of the things we can reflect upon Tuesday's results is I think that the Democrats come in with a strong commitment to new energy technologies. And I think that investment in accelerating the development and deployment of this next generation of ethanol technology is surely a high priority. So I think the jury will be out on that for a while as to whether or not the support needed is there. But to the question of readiness, I would suggest thinking about this way. And also, Eldon, I think you asked, will the technology in 2025 be what we would do in 2012? I think clearly not. I think that we have really spectacular brain power being applied to this problem right now. I think about Stephen Chu out at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. I think about Craig Venter, who cracked the human genome, is now working on this problem. I think that the only thing we can say with certainty is that those guys are going to come up with a better idea than we have today. And that's going to be transformative, and we don't know where it's going to be. But I think that as far as current cellulosic technology, as we understand it, I think we're really some people say, gee, is this still a research problem or is it an engineering problem? I think the answer is it's both. I think we've done a lot in the lab, but clearly we need to build at scale operating units so that we can see what in real life happens. I think that the scale of these things is ginormous. And we need to think about what happens to the bugs in that situation, the throughput. I mean, there's a lot of very practical engineering that needs to go into this. So I would say with certainty that regardless of whether we're exactly at a billion gallons in 2012 or not, the first generation plants are not going to be much like the nth generation plants, but still need to be built. And then the question was a little bit about the investment pathway. And Lou mentioned the multiple pathways of a biorefinery and getting all the value chain out of that, which I think is critically important. But I think we also ought to be open to the idea that we don't, for the reasons I just said, we don't know exactly what those plants are going to look like. There are going to be multiple technologies tried. It's not like we're going to build one plant and answer this question. There are at least a half a dozen very reasonably similarly situated technologies that have a plausible claim to doing this, including which one thing we haven't talked about at all, and that I'm not necessarily advancing, but there are a lot of people who think that the answer on this is gasification and thermal conversion will be a better answer than been on there? Yeah, okay. And then finally the question is what's going to drive this investment? Well, I think it's a vision of the future. You know, we don't know where the future price of oil is, and we can put a lot of stopgap support for that to encourage the investment. But you're potentially investing in an industry that can produce the equivalent of $75 to $1 wholesale gasoline costs out into the future. And if you think that the supply of crude will be constrained either because of the reserves being tapped out or indirectly because some of the more innovative or unconventional resources will fundamentally be off the table because of carbon questions, I think that investing in this is investing in the future of fuels and being able to be a player in one of the world's largest, if not the world's largest industry.
Okay. To start off with the 2025 question and work backwards, you know, clearly if we're doing the same thing in 2025 as we're doing today, our world won't look a whole lot different than it is today. We'll have a bit more ethanol in the market, but won't be a very satisfactory outcome. And hence the imperative that we can't get where we need to go by continuing to do what we do today. We need to focus on developing the technologies. Billion gallons by 2012 isn't about building 50 million gallon plants, because before we build 50 million gallon plants, we got to build a bunch of 1 million gallon plants to prove out technologies. There aren't a lot of things that we can scale up that quickly. We don't have a quite appreciation is wood technology going to be the same as switchgrass technology versus corn stover technology? Building the economic model for switchgrass. Talked about having to completely restructure the economic framework for agriculture in order to make a perennial crop work. A lot of promise on paper, a lot of very practical business difficulties to make that happen. We're seeing a very rapid growth in corn ethanol production today, investment in there because we have a single feedstock, a single dominant product with known byproducts that are easily commercialized, and proven technology. All the necessary conditions for private equity to fund, and private equity number investment is coming in droves. Unproven technology with feedstocks of unknown consistency or quality and and unknown byproducts make a much more complex case, certainly not a private equity world.
Yeah, if I may, do I have time? One of the things that I thought that the several of the speakers pointed out very clearly is just how broad the feedstock and conversion technology options are. You know, I come out of a sort of an R&D background and sort of like to think that you do things in an orderly way and you don't build your pilot plants until you've done things in the lab very thoroughly, and then you don't build production level plants until you have the pilot plants operating. But the same speakers have told us that this is a very urgent problem. And so I think one of the biggest dilemmas I see is this dilemma about sorting out the options and not making mistakes while at the same time beginning to let these biofuels technologies help us with our oil problem, with our liquid fuels problem. And so to me, that's sort of the biggest dilemma. And of course, I am interested in policies and policy options and very interested in comments on that. And I noted that several of you have slides that I will read more than once more, okay? One of the things that occurs to me, Rob, you brought up the point about the corn grower has a floor on how much they're going to get per acre per year. Okay, But the biomass energy crop grower doesn't have that today. Do we need that? Is that?
I think that's pretty clearly what I was saying, or at least that you need to level the field in some way.
Okay.
And I would elaborate slightly to say that I thought my message was pretty clear also, that there are huge non-market benefits for all of us in terms of environmental improvement and perhaps ending that subsidy spiral that we've been in. So, I mean, we tend to talk about energy and fuel, and we're very interested in energy and fuel, but we're also interested in potentially huge positive impacts in the environment from, you know, changing the way we run agriculture as well as the way we consume fuels and what fuels we consume.
Yeah. Reed?
Well, Eldon has just given me an irresistible opportunity to lobby a committee staffer in real time here. So,
a fellow, we don't have, but anyway, go ahead.
Just as an example of something to think about, one of the, many people know, there are approximately 36 million acres in something called the Conservation Reserve Program right now. And this is land set aside, in many cases highly erodible land, to protect it. And the kinds of crops that are planted on it are trees or perennials, including switchgrass. So as we think about a transition to a biomass feedstock supply, one of the things we could think about is that acreage. Now, farmers are engaged in that program on a voluntary basis, 10-year contracts, and those 10-year contracts actually are coming up for renewal in the next couple of years. High likelihood that they will take a fair amount of that out and choose to plant it in corn. Probably not the best idea either for the land or for the public policy choices we're talking about here. So what Congress might think about doing is create perhaps a transition program where farmers could continue to get some of the payment that they're getting for having acreage in this Conservation Reserve Program, but also be allowed to harvest that acreage for perennial crops that protect the soil, continue the soil conservation water runoff benefits. So that would be one way of creating a switchgrass supply, some government support, and get multiple benefits.
Okay. I of course endorse that to a point. Having that land come out of CRP would be a disaster, and I think the impetus is there that it will. You know, recognizing those are marginal lands and switchgrass yields are a ton and a half, 3 tons an acre, that doesn't probably cite a biorefinery there because harvesting that, you know, it's not at the cost that the feedstock needs to be, although it could be supplementary. To get large amounts of biomass, be it corn or anything else, you grow it on good land. And so I would go further and say the CSP gives you ways to create environmental improvements and to, you know, pay farmers for doing environmentally sound things on prime farmland. And I think ultimately we're going to have to get biomass off of prime farmland. We'll also need to get food and feed, but we can do that.
Let me just add one thing to that, which I agree with, but I think it's useful for people to know. When you think about switchgrass in particular, where it'll be grown, the bullseye is not Indiana or Iowa. The bullseye is East Texas. And the reason is, what is switchgrass like? It likes sun and water. It's kind of indifferent to soil. And so we don't need to be on prime Iowa cropland. We need to be a place, and there's abundant area in the sort of Mississippi Delta region that's underperforming economically in terms of agriculture, where switchgrass could be a very attractive alternative to the landowners.
I think that we'll switch away from my sort of personal interest in policy and open up and find out what your interests are and go to question and answers now, if that's okay.
Okay. Yeah. So a couple of rules as we go forward. Thank you for your patience. We do have a roaming microphone. Would you please introduce yourself and state your organization and state your question as a question? And if you'd raise your hand, that'd be great, and we'll go ahead and start.
Good morning. My name's Steve Lehrman. I'm with the office of Senator Mark Pryor. And several of you talked about the problems of infrastructure and delivery of biofuels. And the question that I wanted to ask you is, as you look forward into the future, are you thinking about having a distributed nationwide system where the feedstock is grown locally and you have bioprocessing plants locally, and especially on both the East Coast and the West Coast? Or are we going to be looking more at a system like we currently have with the petroleum industry, where we have very large refineries located in very specific areas of the country?
I think we all have an answer to that. I think from a feedstock standpoint, the feedstock isn't very dense, and then transporting the fuel is difficult. So I think a distributed biomass grows differently in different places. I think a distributed production system, both of biomass and of fuels, is the logical way to go. I think in many ways it's the reverse of what the oil industry was traditionally, where you have a very dense, high energy density and material density feedstock, right, with lots of carbon bonds per kilogram. And we have the opposite condition now. And I think it makes a lot of sense to have smaller scale distributed processing. Now, that's a complete different design problem, right? You're not aiming for the huge economies of scale of oil refineries. And that's a different kind of technology. And whether we have the engineers who can design those kind of plants, that's another challenge.
I actually think you're going to get something that's kind of a mix, and that you're going to get you're going to have a very non-energy dense feed. And whether you convert it directly to products, and some of that will happen closer to the market, or you convert it to a feed to go into some larger scale process that then fits into an infrastructure, in both cases, you're going to have at least densification distributed across the country. And there's a lot of benefits from that, from rural jobs. There's a lot of benefits from that in just general socially. But then you're going to have, because of how things move and the massive scale we're talking about, if we don't change the demand picture, you're also going to have some feeds that tie into existing infrastructure. In my opinion, you need to. Because if you start moving 80 billion gallons of biofuels around, you're going to want to use existing pipelines. You're going to want to use existing conversion facilities. You're going to want to use some existing iron to do it. So I think you're going to see a balanced but if even in a balanced mix, the feed into the infrastructure side of the business is still going to be done with densification rurally. So there's going to be a rural play always in whichever pathway you go.
The way I like to think about that is the oil industry evolved the way it did for a reason. The refineries are either near production centers or near demand centers where there's concentration. Oil comes from a limited number of locations, so you've got concentrated supply, diffuse demand, and the system developed to match that well. With biofuels, we may have a very different scenario where the supply sources are diffuse as well as the demand, and that intrinsically the economics will get you to a more diffuse solution. Mindful of the densification issues, as the technology emerges, we'll learn more about what's the most efficient way to operate.
Thanks. Next question, I think up here.
I guess I'll ask the question. My name is Mike Maul. I'm working at the U.S. Department of State. The talk reminded me, I thought about botany. When I look around the world, there's all these different types of plants. They've evolved to be optimized for their geographic location. And I think Adam talked about this a little bit when you talked about some of your efforts as a company to develop certain plants for specific areas around the world. And then I remember Robert's talk was talking about the enormous amount of research and development has to be done to optimize biofuel production in a particular location. And I was wondering if the panel could talk a little bit about, is that process of optimization going to have to be done all around the world, optimized for different climate regions and different plant species, and how will that make the biofuels international market look like?
I'll take a first crack at that while everybody else gathers their thoughts. I think you raise a couple of conjoined issues there, and I think that there's going to be a transition. I think that what we know today is that there's abundantly underutilized capacity in tropical countries to grow sugarcane. And so there may be a transition of some period of time where conventional technology is used to start this process. I would just offer one statistic to put that in context. You all recall how hard various governments and NGOs worked to provide debt relief to developing countries, particularly in Africa. And yet the run-up in oil prices in the last couple of years in Africa is literally three times the benefit of debt relief. So what we have given with one hand, we have taken away times three with the run-up in oil prices. This is a absolutely critical issue to development, be able to give these countries the ability to produce some indigenous transportation fuels. Probably not at the scale we're talking about, probably starting out in a biodiesel mode or some other kind of mode, but eventually getting to the point that you raise, which is how do you do this at scale? I think that that's an open question. I think that there is a great deal of variety, obviously, of feedstocks around the world. If you're going to go the path that we've all been implicitly talking about here, which is enzymatic hydrolysis, using enzymes, you have to tailor enzymes to the crops. And so you're going to need to have a scale and an investment there, which is probably going to be from the north to the south. But may turn out to be a very large investment in developing country agriculture, which, oh, by the way, is going to benefit food production. So this food versus fuel argument is a complete red herring, in my personal opinion. So and the other possibility would be, let's say we have the technology path we've been sort of describing is not the one that's chosen. It's a thermal path. Well, that's much more forgiving of different feedstocks.
In fact, Reid, that's where I was going to go next. And it depends on your technology path. If we look at biochemical conversion, you're going to be very tied to what your plant resource looks like and what your fuel has to be. If you look at thermochemical, whether it's pyrolysis, whether it's gasification, or those types of processes, you will be much more omnivorous in your feed. And the solution is going to be probably some of both. And you're going to see it emerge around the world depending on that country's indigenous strengths. So you're going to see multiple solutions. One of the difficulties that comes into this is then how do you get international fuel standards, international engine platforms? How does this product get used? So there's going to be a lot of balancing that goes forward from where we are today to where we're going to be in 25 years.
Great questions. Thanks.
I'm Cole Gill. I'm a science policy fellow working at in the Office of Science in the Department of Energy. What's that? Oh, it's, okay. I had a question about scale in terms of the policy implications. So if, unless I'm mistaken, perhaps Doug can remind us what the rough scale is of the biofuels operation is in the in EERE, in Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energies. And also, I guess, Eldon can give us an idea of the scale that we're talking about in terms of subsidies and in terms of the farm bill. And if we can imagine roughly, let's say, 20% of that of those scales, if you had an increment of 20% on top of the scales of policy implications that we're talking about now, what would we do with that? What is a wish list? What are one or two things that we could implement in the near future with, say, $100 million or something like that? And the first two questions obviously go to Doug and Eldon, and then for the rest.
Just quick reminder of EERE's biofuel program scale. If you're talking about budget scale, it's around $45 million a year, roughly. So pretty small. And Eldon, do you want to answer the second?
Well, I certainly can't say what will happen with the energy title budget or the budget that follows the energy bill that was passed a year and a half, a little over a year ago. The one comment I would make, and it's important to keep this in mind, the role of the DOE programs has been R&D, sometimes RD&D, not too often RDD&D. Okay, and so research development, demonstration, and then deployment, and so. What you do with that budget in terms of deployment is generally fairly limited, and yet when we're talking about in a meeting like this, the issues tend to get into that question too. How do you promote deployment that doesn't pick winners but does move these technologies into systems, into production as quickly as possible? And where does that money come from?
I would commend a report that our sort of friendly cousin, the National Commission on Energy Policy, put out that was principally authored by Nathaniel Green at NRDC, but with a lot of academic support, that laid out a pretty comprehensive pathway on R&D increments. My recollection, and this might be a little off, is that they envisioned a $500 million a year program. And that it would be divided essentially into three parts. One is the really innovative Craig Venter make hydrogen out of molecules kind of research. The other end, which is very practical, applied, and demonstration kind of research. And then a section in the middle to kind of conjoin those to try to get the linkage between to get the basic researchers thinking about real world problems so that they're designing their research to yield applicable answers. But I think that clearly that order of magnitude of increase would be well worth making.
And if I was just going to do one area thing, I would say if you look at EERE and NREL, they've got a very powerful, successful cellulosic ethanol program. They do not have a well-funded thermal chemical conversion program. They've got some skills there, but if you were going to do it, you'd augment what they do to look at, again, multiple pathways, because we don't know the right answer today.
Great question. In the back.
Yeah, so Dr. Annex, your yields of 10 dry tons per acre are commendable. You mentioned even under poor water conditions. And that brings me to my question. Water availability and water usage is definitely going to have to be a big piece of this pie. And I was wondering if you could comment on sort of how that figures into what your strategies are, whether they're more research, R&D, or commercial. How does that figure into your strategies to go forward with this?
And could you tell us?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Chad Haynes. I'm from the USDA.
How does it figure in? In terms of biomass production, again, there's a range of crops, and some of which are very drought hardy, right? We can grow sorghum and sorghum sudan grass in Oklahoma and Texas and get relatively high yields, you know, switchgrass similarly, and in places where there's more rain. Now, in terms of processing, right now we use a lot of water when we make corn grain ethanol. Cellulosic ethanol potentially can have a lot more water recycling, and certainly there are other pathways, right? And I am similarly interested in thermochemical, where you'd have a very different water use scenario. So in places where, you know, you can grow biomass, but you may not have enough water to have large 100 million gallon a day biological conversion plants, you might want to have a thermochemical plant there for that reason. I think there's enough water is my answer. Now, There are water quality issues that I think we really have to be very concerned about, both obviously on the biomass production side that I've said a lot about, but I think, you know, we can make big changes. We can make big improvements from where we are today because of cellulosic ethanol, and that can only be a good thing.
I would agree with what Bob just said, but just add that as you look at some of these projections, for example, the Oak Ridge study, none of those includes irrigation. So it's rain-fed agriculture is the basis of all projections. both because of the question you're asking, essentially, and also because of the economics of it. But if you think about the world, there are a lot of tropical regions that have abundant water supply where there's very little useful agriculture.
And the other thing, and we look at water in a number of ways because we're a fairly water-intensive industry anyway. But as you transition from a food crop, a row crop being diverted to energy to an energy crop that is thought about in a sustainable manner, water can be a managed situation. But it can't be, I'm going to plant corn in places that I have to irrigate it too much. There are towns where the water table drops in the middle of summer because people are growing corn where it doesn't grow real well. So you've got to say, okay, how do I manage to convert to energy crops? And then the water situation can be thought through.
I'll come back to that a little bit also. The basic biological sciences, the ability to do, okay, some genetic manipulation. A couple of the seed companies that Iowa State's rather close to, they're putting energy into corn because that's where the money is. But there are some new varieties about to come out that are incredibly drought tolerant. And you can apply that technology to other feedstocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can do an awful lot in terms of how we can make plants be drought tolerant.
Yeah, we're currently in a market that's about corn, and so we're forcing corn to be the solution to the problem, regardless of the local conditions. As we get into the more complex world where we can pick crops that are optimized for geography as well as yield, that will help address the water balance as well. But
further questions? Let's see. We have one here, and then we'll come up front.
Hi, I'm Tom O'Connor with ICF. I have a build on his question earlier related to the infrastructure, and I guess it's primarily for Adam or Lou. As things evolve with the oil industry, as you, I think one of you pointed out, you know, large refineries, very efficient distribution system. What's happening, even if everything works the way we want it on cellulosic ethanol, is at the end of the day, the delivery to the customer is going to take place only into the truck. So you're going to have two totally separate supply chains that have to all work efficiently. And as we move towards plants spread out across the country with cellulosic ethanol and other areas, how do you see that distribution system ever evolving into anything remotely efficient? Isn't it going to have to depend on trucking, rail cars, to be able to really get the product into the terminals? You don't build injection points into Colonial Pipeline for biodiesel in Greenville, North Carolina. It just doesn't work. So how do you see all that? I mean, it'd be great to get to the point that we have this problem, but I'm just wondering how you see a vision of how this distribution system is ultimately going to hang together.
We'll go right to left. I'll get to go first. And then you can go first next time. How about that? If you think back, I actually thought you'd have to have a balanced solution, and there'd be some infrastructure-based products, whether it be things like renewable diesel, whether it be taking pyrolysis oil or algal oils and feeding them into a hydrocracker and making some gasoline that uses the existing base and then has ethanol work into it. And it is a difficult question, the whole infrastructure piece, because if you think about it, in reality, we make capital investments to sell less of what we do when we put an ethanol plant in. You know, it's a negative return investment for us. And we're doing it. We have to comply. But it's going to be one of those things that keeps pushing against. There's negative economics in some places for the folks that have the infrastructure versus others. So it's going to have to be thought through. The other thing is when there gets to be enough ethanol in certain places, the pipelineable problem is a problem. Is it an unsolvable problem? Probably not. Multi-product pipeline, yeah, it's probably unsolvable. Dedicated ethanol pipeline, it's probably solvable. It's just going to be difficult to get there. We think 100 million gallons. You guys think that's big. That's 6,000 barrels. In our world, we say that's minuscule. 6,000 barrels is tiny. We do 200,000, 300,000 barrel a day refineries. So the gathering system and the transportation system is very difficult to get the economics across, but eventually scale is going to drive something to get you away from rail cars and trucks.
The way I like to think of it is not so much as the product side where we have big refineries going to diffuse demand, but I think more further upstream oil fields where we have gathering systems of pipelines. So maybe not everywhere, but how many ethanol plants are there in Iowa now? Could you put in a gathering system that delivers the pipelines ethanol to Chicago? Maybe you could. Don't know that, but that's a business problem much more than a technical or scientific problem.
Okay, we have some up here, Jennifer.
Thank you. My name is Johanna Mendelson with CSIS. I wanted to add to the infrastructure question with a different twist. We never had a chance to deal with the security implications of our oil industry, and we've seen how vulnerable both our oil and gas infrastructure is in this day and age. To the extent that you can create a new infrastructure for all of these bioenergy products, sometimes perhaps a wide distribution system in various locations might be a better security solution. And I wonder if people are thinking about the options, given that we lost 25% of our refining capacity during Katrina, what would the implications of a more dispersed system and the creativity of thinking of dispersion have on this equation? And to what extent is there any legislative implication of this that could be pursued in the next few years as new products are coming online?
That was a great comment in the form of a question.
I think to inform the legislation, one needs to do some studies, and there hasn't been much done. There are some solicitations coming out that universities like mine will respond to. I happen to be running a workshop at NSF December 4th and 5th on interdependent networks, infrastructure networks, including, one might think, biofuels and the security issues associated. And if one has some answers, right, what sort of that's worth or what the implications are, you can inform policy a bit better. That's all I have to offer. I'm sorry at this point.
There's, you know, two reasons why refineries are concentrated. One, that's the crude flow. Two is most people don't want to live next to an oil refinery. And, you know, in the Farm Belt, people apparently feel relatively okay about living next to an ethanol plant. In many cases, they're locally owned, and that's a source of economic development to our community. As we get to production facilities located closer to urban areas to develop cellulosic ethanol, that may prove to be more of a challenge for us, and we'll have to see how to best manage that.
Great. We'll go to another.
I'm Bob Miller. I'm chairman of the Islamic Development Initiative. So I want to ask a question about the Sud, gigantic swamp in the middle of Africa. Any possibilities there? That's kind of a side question. Second question is there such a thing as cellulosic butanol, which can be used existing infrastructure? And is it simply a question of designing enzymes to deliver that rather than ethanol?
Yeah. There is cellulosic butanol, because when you think about it, there's two parts to the process. One is taking your feedstock and turning it into sugar. The second is turning the sugar into either ethanol or butanol. The front end, whether we turn corn into sugar or turn cellulosics into sugar, is a process. The end result is the same. Getting that sugar into a different product, you're correct. That is the enzyme, and that's why we say that conversion to butanol is not that big a deal. It can use a lot of what's already been developed for ethanol.
And to
your first question, if you've got a lot of sunshine, you've got a lot of water, and you've got a lot of nutrient, you can grow a lot of biomass, whether that be in the form of algae, whether that be in the form of a different oil seed crop, whether it be a different, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look. Those are great inputs that produce a lot of biomass.
Being a university professor, I'm going to go really far out on you here, which is one of the things that people worry about with cellulosic ethanol is you're taking a lot of biomass off off the land now, and with it goes the nutrients, right? The plant nutrients, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium. And in a livestock system, that stays there. Well, those things are pollutants. I mean, they're contaminants when you're making ethanol, right? Ethanol is nothing more than CO2, water, and sunshine. Mm-hmm. There's no N, P, or K in there. Well, we're developing some technologies where we can capture those nutrients and put them back on the land, right? It'll save energy. It's good for the sustainability of farming. But moreover, we can capture a bunch of the carbon. So in sub-Saharan Africa, you have cation exchange capacity poor soils. What does that mean? It means you put fertilizer on and it goes away and it doesn't stay there. Well, when you take the char from a pyrolysis unit or a gasification unit, put the N, P, and K in there and put it on the soil, you can build the soil significantly. You could significantly increase the agricultural productivity in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, these are expensive plants, and, you know, Uganda's not going to be siting one in the very near future. But there's a potential there to really improve some marginal soils and produce some, you know, increase some agricultural productivity.
Thanks for that. We have time for one or two more questions.
Thank you. First, let me say, you guys did a terrific job. And the more we get into this topic, the more I think people need to know. Bringing it back to a policy discussion, Reed talked about this, Eldon talked about it. Tom prompted the question, I think. When we get into a situation, we all talk about winners and losers and being caught between first generation and subsequent generation. Simple digesters, I'm getting the sense, can't do what biorefineries and other more technical process streams, conversion capacity that we're going to need. On the one hand, in the absence of like a federal standard or legislation that's specific, we're seeing out in the states different programs developing. At what point from a policy perspective does that stop being helpful and becomes an impediment to a more systematic development of things? I mean, you know, Eldon, your point about we want to do this systematically and optimize, but at the same time we want to do it fast when there's a lot of uncertainty. How do we get across this chasm?
I'll dive in just quickly. As the second largest refiner in the United States who produces a number of gasolines, both conventional gasoline and BOBs, before oxygenated blends, that we then put into the existing pipeline system. When we have multiple different state content, renewable content mandates, 10% ethanol here, 5% ethanol there, a different here, a different there, we have to make different gasolines for each one of those. And that is an incredibly difficult situation for us. A common national standard is a much better answer than multiple diverse state solutions.
I wasn't sure that was exactly what you were asking, but I'll answer what I thought you were asking, which is more about sort of experimentation in different paths at the state level. I think Eldon was right that if we had the luxury of time, we would do this in a much more focused way. We would do more R&D, more pilot scale, more demonstration scale, more, you know, it would be a nice 30-year program. We don't have 30 years. So I'm in favor of throwing everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Are there more questions from the audience? Well, great. We're going to wrap this up here. Let me before we thank the speakers, let me encourage you, if you have not signed in to our registration desk, please drop a business card off with Jennifer outside. There are a number of folks who did not sign in. I'd like to have you join me in thanking the speakers. And we'll do that.
And comment.
And I'd like to remind you that on December 12th will be the next session in our series, and that one will be one of multiple ones focused on, I'll call it, carbon to liquid, so not bio, but alternative fossil sources. And so please join us then and look for that announcement. Thank you all very much.